from the magnolia trees in the meadow. King harvest is surely come.
A dry summer then come fall.
Well, there we have the theme music for the Organic Farm Stand, and you are tuned to WPKN. The Organic Farm Stand comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month from 12 to 1. My name is Richard Hill. Chris Ferriero is here today, which is a great thing. And, of course, we have Guy Beardsley, who is still trying to master the art of...
Walking.
To put it bluntly.
Right.
But, well, yeah, Guy Beardsley, who was, I guess, cozy and warm at the old not the old solar farm, at Guy's Eco Garden.
Right.
Guy's Eco Garden up there in the White Hills of Shelton. Guy, so maybe just a quick word about how you're going there with the physical therapy. And
well, physical therapy is finished. Occupational therapy is finished. I do not have any outpatient theory. I have yet to get the doctor's approval for getting back on the tractor and for doing other farm-type work, but including splitting wood. But I expect to get that here on the 8th of this month. So I should be operational. And the next time we have a program, which, of course, is going to be on the 17th, we're going to have, I should be on board.
You think you'll be actually be here in the studio?
I hope so. That's my plan.
Well, that is a good goal. That is a good goal. But we'll forgive you if you don't make it, because you don't want to rush these kinds of things. You know, get it right the first time, and it'll be for keeps.
Well, you know, just walk into from the parking lot up the stairs and to the office is not a huge problem.
Yeah, those. I'll tell you something. Those stairs to the third floor at Cox Student Center are becoming a challenge for me too, though.
Yes, so, especially when you're.
I use the handrail without any trouble.
Oh yeah, especially when you have like a crate full of records. That's makes it extra difficult.
Right. Exactly.
But I'm glad you're here, Guy.
Good show. Thank you, Chris.
The voice is strong. Okay, so Guy, why don't we kick it right off? Actually, you know what? Let me tell folks what we're going to be doing today, because it's a little unusual. Last couple of months, we promised that Vincent Kay would, once a month, the first show of each month, would be with us to give a kind of a honeybee update. And there's all kinds of information, even though the honeybees are obviously less active in the colder weather and hibernate, I suppose. We'll find all about that. But there is all kinds of information that potential beekeepers and amateur beekeepers and people that are trying to get into the profession would love to know about the bee culture, the bee ecology, and all the kind of issues around the environment and other things that are important to know about beekeeping and bee, the whole issue of, the world of bees. And so Vincent's going to do his very first 10-minute bee update today. We'll kick that off in just a couple of minutes. And then we have one more special feature today, and that is that Sam King from Blue Earth Compost is going to be with us by phone. And he's going to tell us all about the operation of this amazing business, which is industrial but also residential composting process, where they pick up all kinds of, well, we're going to hear the whole story from him, but basically it's kind of a compost to energy process, and it's also a way of you being able to compost things that are not normally, can't really go in the backyard composting. And but it's a fascinating story and a really interesting operation they have. We're going to hear about that with Sam King, and we'll given that the PSAs went a little bit over the start time of our show, we'll probably get Sam on the phone at about 12:30. So that's the lineup for today. If there's time, we'll take your calls as well here at WPKN. We are in fundraising mode, so even though we're not playing Beatles music this hour, the spirit of the Beatles are always alive and well. And I do believe we have a couple of folks. Let me just take a peek. They may be running around trying to get a muffin or something over. But we do have some people who may be able to take your calls. And you can always go straight to the website, WPKN.org, and make your donation directly there. It's safe and secure. So let's kick it off, Guy, with what's life like on the farm? We've had some very bizarre weather shifts, and today we are getting a sense of what November is going to be like. But tell us a little bit about life on the farm.
Well, I tell you, we have had a great September. It's the very best September that I can ever remember. And, you know, right now we still have a good bit on the farm. Kale and beets and lettuce and peppers and tomatoes. The Brussels sprouts are coming along really great. The rutabaga is ready to come out, at least some of it. And the garlic has been out, and we have our black garlic in store, and so... You know, all kinds of great things are happening out here. Even though today it's a little murky, that's all good too. We need to have some of that moisture every now and then. So anyway, and the flowers are still great. That's another great thing. You know, all these things. Of course, we haven't had even a close to frost situation yet, and that's good. But we anticipate those matters are going to be frost. Now, what we have been able to do, or what I think everybody in the business of growing things should do, is now is the point, appropriate time to figure out what was good this season and what was bad, considering it the seed catalogs are coming out nowadays, and so you'll be planning what you're going to grow next year. And also another important point at this time of the year is that is to keep the soil covered, because if you don't cover it with what you want in the form of green manure crops, nature is going to cover it with weeds or some things like that, some invasive species of things. So anyway, get your cover crops on right quick. And now, we've had a really great time here with our lavender this year, and I was just out yesterday looking at our grapes, and of course, we just have wine grapes, but I tell you, I got out there, I took one of those little purple grapes, and my goodness, it was outstanding. And so I think it's been a pretty good year for grapes, even though we had all that rain up until about the middle of August. But, you know, that period of time from the middle of August on till now has been fairly dry, and that is what has ripened the grapes up so that they do have a really good brix. And that's what you really want to have for either table grapes or wine grapes. Anyway, our grapes, which are wine grapes, but they're worthwhile just going out there and grabbing a couple of bunches and pulling off the purple ones, because they are really good to eat, seeds and all. If you don't mind seeds, that's great. Okay, so what we have, our lavender has been good. Now, I have to caution everybody that really wants to grow lavender, and because we've had a huge number of people during the course of the season that want to know how to grow lavender, because and some people have been successful at it. But if you're going to grow lavender, you should have had it planted well before now. We usually get ours planted sometime in the early part of summer so that it has a chance to grow up and get nice and bushy. And you put what you want to do, though, is have it in a raised bed, and you have to put it in an area that is not going to flood. Lavender and water, particularly in the roots, do not get along at all well together. So with the lavender, which is doing great, the black garlic, which is in good shape, The tomatoes, which, oh, I got to say one thing about tomatoes. I was very disappointed this year in our Mountain Merit tomatoes. For some reason or another, we planted them and we took care of them. We gave them a collar of compost and we took good care of them. But they did not have, in my opinion, the flavor that they've had in past years. I don't know if any of the other radio listeners have had any problem with the Mountain Merit. Mountain Merit has always been a pretty good-sized slicing tomato that has had not outstanding flavor, but good flavor. But this year, the flavor was very flat. And it may have something to do with what we did or didn't do. But anyway, that's a comment on our Mountain Merit. It's been a great year for cucumbers, and almost every single type of cucumber we put in did really well, and we had 7 plantings of cucumbers. But cucumbers are pretty much finished right now, at least in my my place. Maybe some people, if you're running them in the greenhouses, you're going to have still good cucumbers. You know, cucumbers are a remarkable fruit. Stop headaches, stop hiccups, and other things that act like that. Now, Richard, maybe you or Chris might have a comment here.
I was going to ask you about you said you have grapes, and they are, quote, wine grapes. That is to say, purple grapes?
Grapes are called Baco Noir, and it's a black grape. It's more than purple. It's a dark, dark purple. Baco Noir. It's a small grape, but they're very prolific, and they have a great Brix this year.
What is a Brix?
Brix is a sweetness. The sweetness and the flavor. Not just sweetness, but flavor, too. Mm. And that helps to make a great wine out of it.
Guy, I wanted to ask, are Concord grapes used for wine, or mostly they're used for jam?
Well, you could use grapes for, if you want to have grapes for jam or juice, then you need to process them in a different sort of facility. Ours, we process ours for wine, and it involves throwing the whole grapes, including the grape bunches, including the stems and everything else, mm-hmm. in there. And this machine, which is pretty smart, it separates the grapes from the vines, spits the vines out on one side, and then crushes the grapes. And then you put all that into a big vat and container and cover it up, and then watch it or take care of it while it ferments.
Okay, but my question was Concord grapes. Are they? Do they ever use those for wine?
Regular table grapes?
Well, Concord grapes.
Concord grapes, what you're talking about, the wild Concord grapes.
Yeah, they're kind of like, they're round and purple, basically.
Yeah, they're big size. Yeah, you could use them. Absolutely, you could use them. But not designed specifically for wine. Primarily, a Concord grape is a great table grape, If you've, we have a lot of Concord grapes growing around the fences. And they're, of course, wild. But my aunt used to make sure that all us little nephews of hers would go out there and give her a whole bunch of Concord grapes during the course of the year, and she'd make both grape juice and grape jam, or grape jelly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And okay. She was really good at that, but she could take and make lye soap and make grandma's cookies because... She had all the old recipes from the 1800s, even.
Hmm. Well, Guy, thank you very much. Because of our late start today and the fact that we do have three people on the phone, we have to get three people on the phone in and out, let's shift over and bring in Vincent Kay from Swords into Plowshares Honey. I'm having a great day here. To tell us, give us your honeybee update, Vincent, our first installment of a once-a-month feature that we're going to do here on the Organic Farm Stand.
Well, hello, Richard. It's great to be back again. And, yesterday we were in bee suits. It was pretty warm out, and we were making the rounds to... It takes us 2 or 3 days to get to all the hives that we have, because we have hundreds of hives spread out in Connecticut, but we... are basically taking the lids, the outer covers, and putting them in their winter position, because we usually provide ventilation for the hives. It gets awfully warm in there in the summer, and so we prop the lids open, let the air flow in and out and up to the top of the hive and out. So we reduce that now, and so that it takes them less energy to keep the inside of the hive warm on these cool nights. Most of the flowers, as you know, are almost done blooming. It's mostly from the dryness, and you know every flower has its course, its longevity, and it begins and ends. And so the goldenrod and asters are just kind of petering out now. But it's been a great September because we haven't had a lot of rain, and a lot of the flowers were able to bloom, and the bees have been gathering just an amazing amount of nectar and pollen. In fact, if you're a beekeeper and you have a hive, one of the things that we always enjoy doing is getting down on hands and knees, all fours, and putting your nose right up to the entrance of the hive. Of course, do it carefully so that you're not stung. But the smells coming in and out of the hive, especially with the goldenrod nectar, is just remarkable. It smells just like a field of goldenrod. And, of course, the bees are gathering this nectar, and they're fanning their wings over it as they put it in the cells to evaporate the moisture. And that's what reduces it to honey. That's the process the bees use. And but the smell is just intoxicating. It's just a wonderful, wonderful time of year, especially on a cool evening at the end of the day. You can smell because the bees have been gathering that nectar all day long. But in any event, if you're not a beekeeper, you won't have access to a hive, so that won't happen. But it's coming to an end. And, you know, we harvest our honey in the summer, in the very humid part of the summer, because the honey glides out of the combs in the big centrifuges that we use. We spin the combs, and the honey flies out, and we filter it, and it just everything flows a lot better in the warm weather. However, if beekeepers now have said, well, we've got to get around to harvesting our honey, it's not too late, but the only thing you may find is that it may be a little harder to spin out of the combs, and sometimes even it starts to granulate in the combs. Those early spring honeys that you have been in there for the whole summer sometimes granulate, and that's a whole other discussion, but there's no way you can spin that out of a comb, so you'll probably end up feeding that back to the bees if that has happened. In general, you know, this is a good time to start preparing for winter for the bees, to check the weight of the hive to kind of give it a little heft, and you can tell how much honey is actually in the hive. And in Connecticut, usually you need anywhere from 60 to 80 pounds of honey for the bees to make it through the winter, because they don't hibernate, Richard. Their metabolism slows down, but they certainly don't go to sleep.
Okay.
They stay active inside the hive all winter long. And in fact, they consume honey and pollen, and that metabolism is converted to heat. And that's what keeps the hives warm. In fact, if you take one of the lids off of a beehive in sub-zero weather, you'll be hit with a blast of hot air, probably 70 or 80 degrees coming out of the hive, which, of course, you do not want to do because that will kill the hive. But that's the kind of heat buffer that exists inside the hive, even in the coldest part of the winter. The other thing that beekeepers have to do is make sure there is some ventilation on the upper cover so that carbon dioxide can escape from the hive during the process of consuming honey. If not, it's going to condense and form moisture and then drip back down onto the cluster of bees and probably freeze them. So it's a very delicate balance. They have to have enough food and they have to have enough air, but not too much, because then you again break that buffer of warmth and cold. Other things that beekeepers can start doing is mowing around the hives to keep rodents from going into the hives during the winter, which, of course, you know, a mouse certainly wants to be next to or somewhere inside a hive of bees where it's nice and warm and the bees are not that active. But you can reduce the entrances so that the mice can't get in, provide ventilation. And, of course, all your medications should have been applied already, but certainly if you haven't harvested honey yet, now is the time after harvesting to apply your medications for mites and anything else you might want to do to make the hive make it through the winter.
Two questions, Vincent.
Yes.
We're speaking with Vincent Kay, Swords into Plowshares. Honey is his game. And Vincent, you mentioned the bees when they bring the nectar back into the hive and the pollen, they fan it with their wings, and that is what reduces it. It evaporates the moisture, and that's what turns it into honey. Did I get that right?
Yes, and then what they do is they seal it over with beeswax so that no other moisture will go into the honey. And provided that seal isn't broken, that honey will stay perfect. And the bees somehow know the right moisture content. It's amazing. It's really quite amazing. But that honey will never go bad. It's a perfect food source. And, in fact, they've taken honey out of the pyramids 2,000 years old, and it's perfectly it's just perfect. It's edible. It's like the day the bees put it in the comb.
And so is there any part of the honeycomb, the sort of the structure that the bees put their honey into, or the nectar and pollen into, that they don't build? I mean, do they build that entire structure? Is that something that you provide?
No, they build that entire structure. Now, of course, honeycomb is what they put honey into, and it's made from beeswax, which is a substance that they excrete from a gland on their abdomen, and they knead it in the warm weather with their, you know, their mouth and their legs, and they form it into these perfect shapes, the honeycomb shape. And but they use the comb for other things as well. They put pollen, which is different than nectar, but they put the pollen in the comb. And they also, the queen lays eggs in the comb, both for worker bees and drones. So those two different cells are a slightly different size, but that also is made from beeswax as well. But it's a remarkable substance because it retains heat, it repels water or moisture, and it's one of an amazing substance. Of course, we know it as beeswax for candles and other purposes. One of the biggest users of beeswax in World War II was the military, because everything got sprayed with beeswax as a water repellent, ammunition, tank treads, clothing, boots. And so they petitioned beekeepers in the United States to donate their beeswax to the war effort, which a lot of them did. And so in any event, that's just a little side, but it's a remarkable substance.
Indeed, and it's one of the most wonderfully fragrant substances I've ever encountered.
Well, that smell actually comes from the honey and the pollen. In fact, the color of beeswax, when it's first produced by the bees, is snow white. It's as white as white can be. And what gives it the yellow color is the dyes in the pollen, the natural dyes in the pollen, as the bees are bringing that in on their legs and feet, actually rubs off onto the beeswax, and that's what gives it its color.
Wow, amazing. Yeah. Well, listen, Vincent, this has been a wonderful first episode of the Vincent Kay Honeybee Update. And there's surprisingly a lot of things to talk about through the winter.
There is. And I'm honored to be invited. And hopefully we'll do it again. And it's always going to be hard. You're going to have a hook to pull me off the stage. There's a lot of details to talk, but it's been a pleasure. So
well,
thank you so much.
Absolutely, you've raised many questions, which are swirling around Chris's and my minds, and no doubt Guy's as well. And so we'll make a list and hit you with them next time. And you'll be back the first Thursday of November for that. So thank you, Vincent Kay, with the Honeybee Update.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks, Vincent.
Thank you
Goodbye.
So much.
All right. Perfect. And great. And in a moment, we're going to have Sam King from Blue Earth Compost on the phone. And if Chris and Guy will engage in a little badinage,
sure.
We'll get him on the phone.
So Guy, actually, I did have a question for you
Go ahead.
Regarding perennial herbs, which I have Some in my garden.
Yeah.
For the winter, because you talk about cover crops, I have a tendency to basically place compost on top of my garden to protect it.
That's good. That's
but,
good.
But
you can do that. That's fine.
But my question was with perennial herbs, you normally, like, cut them back and then cover them over with leaves or something? Or
well, it depends upon
what they are.
The type of herb. In some cases, for example, with rosemary, which is a traditional one that we'd like to keep. We'll bring a couple of plants inside, but we'll leave a number of them outside and cover them up. Cover them up with row cover. That's all, just row cover, and it sort of keeps the wind off of them. And most of them will exist even in really cold weather. But the ones that we really depend upon are the ones we bring inside, and just sort of keep them moist is all, and keep them out of the sun so that they're, say, cool, dry, and dark as much as possible. Of course, they could get a little light, but that doesn't hurt them very much.
So basically, just say, for example, sage. Which is one thing I have.
We leave our sage in the ground.
Okay, so
we've never had a problem with that.
Sage
is really a tough plant, at least for us. We have it right out here in the garden.
Yeah, it's kind of like
it comes back every year and spreads.
Yeah, it's kind of like oregano. Oregano is almost like a weed,
which we plant every year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we don't forget oregano. To hang in there. But we don't really plan for it to do either, because if you start seeds every year, you can have a better control over the crop you're going to produce than the one that's already there, if you follow me on that.
Yeah, I find, like, the oregano I've had for, like, 4 or 5 years, I would say, and it survives the winter fine.
Okay, well, it hangs in there good. That's good for you then, Chris. Well, we just plan on a new oregano every year, and we have it spread out in several different plantings.
So you recommend just, like, basically kind of covering, putting compost on top of those or around them to protect them?
Thyme several of these other, I just can't think of a whole bunch of other things that we use, but, of course, basil won't...
basil's an annual.
Temperature
yep.
much below 40 anyway.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks, Guy. I believe we have our guest.
Okay.
Yeah, in theory, we have our guest, and I would like to thank Sam King, who is one of the management team that runs Blue Earth Composting, which is based in Hartford, Connecticut, for joining us here today on the Organic Farm Stand. Sam, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Great to have you. So we're going to start from the beginning here. Just tell us, what is Blue Earth Compost, and what are its many, tentacles of operation? And are you just in a Connecticut operation, or do you have a regional presence as well?
Sure, certainly. Yeah, I could take you through the whole thing. Be happy to do so. Blue Earth Compost was started in 2013 in West Hartford, Connecticut. And it was started by a woman named Susanna Castle, who had just finished up a master's degree at Duke. And in her master's degree, the thesis was based on a similar company to the one that we operate now called Compost Now, which is based out of the Research Triangle. And basically what Blue Earth Compost does, and what Compost Now does as well, is we are providing the infrastructure to change our waste, the way that we operate waste in terms of what goes on with food. We're changing that infrastructure so that instead of throwing all that food that doesn't get eaten into our landfills and into incinerators, we're making sure that we're getting that full cycle that food is involved with and bringing it back to compost instead. So... we got started, like I said, in 2013 with just working with residential customers that were in the West Hartford and Hartford area. It was very small at that point. It was only about 20 customers. Just helping them to, get them little green pails and putting them on a collection route. We would take all that compost, bring it to a commercial composting facility, and get it turned back into soil. That company grew. We added lots of residential customers. In 2015, we added a commercial service, so picking up from in the beginning, a senior living facility and some small schools around here. And it just continued to grow. We've been lucky to partner with lots of great organizations in the area, nonprofits, government, through schools, and private companies, to the point where we're composting millions of pounds per year now. We have a staff of about 7 people that operate out of our space in Hartford, Connecticut, where we moved in 2016. We operate across much of the state now. Our residential service is mostly based out of the Metro Hartford region, but we have some little satellite operations as well, and that covers about 20 towns. And the commercial service has a much bigger swath of territory. It does most of the highway corridors in the state, 91, 95, Route 8, Route 2. We got our trucks going everywhere, picking up this stuff so that we can keep it out, like I said, of the incinerator and the landfill and putting it back towards its intended use, which is to, make more soil so we can grow more food.
So tell us what happens. We're going to get into some of the different variations on what you do, the residential versus the commercial pickups and anything. But whatever you pick up, what happens to it when you pick it up? What do you do with it, and what process does it go through to render it back into something that you could spread on your garden? Or are there other byproducts from that can be used for other purposes?
Certainly, yeah. Once we picked it up, we bring it to a facility right now in Southington, Connecticut. It's called Quantum Biopower. And Quantum Biopower is what's called an anaerobic digester. And it is a very technical composting plant. And the end result is that you are able to get compost and make electricity out of the process as well. And I can go into a little more detail if you'd like about how that process works.
Well, it would be interesting to know, because actually somewhere along the line I heard that, when anything decomposes like that, it does release methane gas. And so, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just going from hearsay from various sources.
No, yeah, that's a perfect observation, and it really helps to explain the process.
So, the methane gas is released through the decomposition. Is that part of what you said, creating electricity? Is the methane gas used to do that, or?
Yeah, exactly. So if we think about the natural process of composting, whether you do it in your backyard or whether you do it in industrial scale, which is generally done with windrows, so these large, basically just large mounds of decomposing matter mixed with small amounts of finished compost, it's going to be releasing methane during the decomposition process. And methane itself is according to a lot of the estimates that I've heard from climate scientists, it's about 20 to 40 times more damaging as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, based on where that methane molecule is in its life cycle. So obviously this is something that is, when we're doing something good like composting, there's this consideration that we need to be thinking about. And anaerobic digestion offers a solution to that by capturing the methane and then burning it in a diesel generator to produce electricity, the byproduct being carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide is obviously a much less potent greenhouse gas, and it puts it to use. So this is considered a renewable energy. And in that regard, they're able to power at this one facility the equivalent of about 750 homes worth of electricity during the day at all times. And at the same time, they're producing a compost product that can be used to grow more food. So it's a double bang for your buck. And it's a really great technology that has been very well adopted in places like Germany and Spain and France, places where they don't really have space for landfilling, places where there's been a much more aggressive trend towards trying to bring renewable energy online.
So let's get down and dirty and tell us what kinds of things you accept as compost for either your commercial or residential pickups. In other words, is it the usual thing like, the things that we compost in our backyards, or are there other things that you accept that would not be really digestible in the very natural composting systems that we use in our homes?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, we can take everything that you'd use at home. So veggie scraps, fruit scraps, coffee grounds, eggshells, stuff like that. But we can additionally take things like meat, dairy, cheese, bones, things that you wouldn't compost in your backyard because, you know, A, they would attract pests, and B, because the proteins are just too strong to break down at the small level that we can do in our own homes. So we can take those things because we're able to compost at scale and break down those stronger proteins.
So, what about the things that you see some that are appearing now in some of the health food stores where they'll say, these plastic bags, produce bags that they have on the rollers and you pull them off and they have a slightly green tinge to them and they say recyclable bags, but only in industrial composting sites. Are those objects recyclable in the anaerobic digester that you have?
So compostable products are a really interesting and complex issue. They are, in theory, a really great idea in terms of a way to replace our single-use plastics and other products that are often made out of petroleum. But they are not a silver bullet by any means. The thing that we need to be considering is that, like they say on there, that they're only compostable in industrial facilities. So obviously off the bat, that takes everybody who wants to compost at home, it takes them off the table.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing additionally is that many composting facilities are not super happy about some of these products, especially the ones that are called PLAs. They're the plastics that you might see that they make a cold cup out of. They're often clear plastic that's somewhat heavy. They often also make like plastic forks and spoons and stuff like that.
We've seen those.
And and a lot of the traditional windrow composters that we're seeing, their processes are not having good results. So they're not able to break these down as well as they need them to be in order to work on the timelines that they do. You know, a commercial composter wants to be able to turn any kind of food product or paper product that they get to compost within about 90 days. And the ones that we've been working with in Connecticut, they're not able to break them down in 90 days. So they're still seeing a lot of plastic fragments. So that's been one issue. The bags break down. They're a lot thinner of a product. The paper products, they're all breaking down, but the thicker plastics, we're still having some trouble. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more research and development on the production side, or there just needs to be an evolution of processes on the composting side.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the other thing, if you don't mind if I continue.
Oh, no, go on.
The other thing that confounds this as well is that anaerobic digesters, like the one that we're talking about in Southington, they have a mechanical sorting process because they recognize that they wanted to be able to take in a large amount of material. For instance, they do 40 tons per day of food scraps. So it's a pretty big amount. And they wanted to be able to take it in from places that they knew, you know, weren't going to be the best sorters. You know, not everybody gets 100% rates, you know, when they're diverting, when they're, you know, sorting at the source, when they're, you know, when you're at your restaurant or you're at your school, you know, the occasional fork or plastic glove is going to end up in the compost. And a place like Quantum Biopower didn't want to, you know, be rejecting the load just because of an errant glove, you know? So they put in mechanical sorting, when they started their system. And the unintended consequence of that is that any kind of compostable product that comes through their process is going to be seen the same way that a single-use plastic would be seen. So it's not going to know the difference between whether you made this fork out of cornstarch plastic or whether you made it out of, you know, petroleum-based plastic. Mm. They're both going to get kicked out of the process. So they don't really offer a solution for those products as well. So the unfortunate circumstance is that not all of the compostable products that are being produced and sold here in Connecticut are getting composted. The silver lining to that whole thing is that, in general, the processes that these companies use when they make the single-use plastics, when they make these compostable-based plastics, is that they're making them out of materials that harm the environment less than petroleum-based ones do. So there's the net benefit there. And a lot of these companies that are producing them are intrinsically, you know, as part of their mission, they're trying to be softer and gentler on the environment. And I know, for example, one of the companies that we've worked with in the past that make these, they power their plants 100% off renewable energy. So it's, like I said at the beginning, it's a very complex and evolving process with compostables, and maybe you're getting a little bit more information that you thought you were going to get on this answer, but I just like to, you know, I like to be able to tell people about, like, the full scope of what's going on.
No, this is the real nitty-gritty that we all do really want to know, because we do our own composting. Everybody tries to do their recycling and that kind of thing, and there's all kinds of questions about, when you put the stuff in the blue bin, what are they actually going to recycle? And the real story is quite different from the imagined story about what gets recycled. So, no, this is the stuff we need to hear. What I'd like to do now is to have you talk a little bit about the residential process, the pickups that you do. Now, I live in the town of Brantford, and actually the reason that I'm speaking to you today is because Bill Horn, who is one of our great environmental resources in Brantford, had met with you or somebody from your company and told me about it, and I was fascinated. So, and then he said, well, they may start doing pickups in Brantford, residential pickups. And I understand that has started in Brantford. Am I correct?
Yep.
That right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So,
yeah.
Could you describe what the system for residential pickups is, and what customers have to do, and what they pay, and what they get for that?
Certainly, and shout out to Bill Horn if he's listening. So, the process that we use is we give people a container. It's a 4-gallon pail. We line it with one of these plastic biodegradable bags. And we put them on a collection schedule. So everybody in Brantford and Guildford gets picked up on Tuesdays. We go around everybody's house. Right now we have somebody picks it up in a pickup truck. We empty out the container, tie a new bag to the handle of the container, and then we go on our merry way and pick up your neighbor. It's a very simple process. We bring all that stuff to Quantum Biopower, like I said, so it gets composted. And then, in addition to, you know, knowing that you're doing the right thing, the customer also gets up to three 50-pound bags of compost of finished soil back per year as a full circle way of saying thank you and keeping them connected to the process. And people use that compost for, you know, everything from small garden plots, amendments, helping out their indoor and outdoor plants, and just generally, you know, making sure that soil gets back into the biosphere. The cost is $25 per month, and you can save a little bit money off the monthly price by doing like a longer subscription. And we started it in August. We have about 50 customers. So that's really going well to start, and we want to keep expanding it. We started as well doing commercial collections in Brantford, and so we've gotten a great response from people down in that area. I think that there's a really nice level of consciousness around environmental issues, and there's a great group of people who want to see these types of things happen, like Bill Horn.
Yes, indeed. So actually, give us a survey of some of the other towns. You mentioned two shoreline towns, Brantford and Guildford. Where else are you doing residential pickups?
Yeah, like I said, the majority of it's in the Metro Hartford area. So if I just went through the list, I would be Hartford, West Hartford, East Hartford, South Windsor, Manchester, South Windsor, Windsor, Bloomfield, Canton, Avon, Simsbury, Farmington, New Britain, Newington, Wethersfield, and Middletown.
If there are customers in towns that you did not mention who would like you to consider doing residential or commercial pickups in their towns, what do they need to do to try to get you, to lure you into their areas?
Sure. Well, so if you're a commercial customer and you're not in one of the towns that I just mentioned, I would recommend that you still reach out to us because our commercial territory incorporates more than our residential territory. But if you're a residential and if you're, you know, somebody who lives in, you know, let's say Berlin, or if you live in, I don't know, Hamden, and you weren't on that list, the first thing to do, what I would recommend is, you know, go onto our website and you can still sign up and it'll just put you on the waiting list so that we can see how much interest there is in a town, and that can help us to make decisions about future expansions. Brantford and Guilford are actually a really great example of that because we didn't have any plans in expanding there. It doesn't, in a lot of senses, it's pretty far away from our base, but we had a group of people who were just really fervent about doing the organizing that was necessary in order to build the customer base for it to make sense for us sustainably, and also for it to make sense for the amount of food that we're diverting in order to, you know, because that's a consideration. You know, we're driving miles in order to do this. So we have to make sure that the amount of food that we're collecting has a net positive for the environment when we actually take the full accounting into consideration. So, you know, once we get to certain levels of the towns, and every town is a little bit different depending on how close they are to present towns that we service. But, you know, if we can get enough customers in a town, then we could put them online as well.
So, Sam, actually, I have a question for you. So what is it about your process that allows you to decompose animal products as opposed to someone at home doing it? Is it just like the temperatures involved with the decomposition? Or because I know at home probably people, there isn't enough to create the heat to kill the bacteria from the animal protein.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, is it correct. Just the large process? There's more heat build up and it kills more bacteria?
That's right. Yep.
Okay.
In a traditional composting facility, the windrow variety that I was talking about before, they're able to get the piles of soil to about 140 degrees, which is what you really need in order to be able to consistently break down the bacteria and the proteins. Mm-hmm. You know, if you stuck a thermometer in your backyard composting pile, during the summer months, you can definitely get those temperatures if you're doing like a really good job.
Right.
But they're able to do it consistently throughout the year, 365 days. Doesn't matter if there's a foot of snow on top of their compost pile, they can still get the temperatures needed to do that.
So it's just the basically the mass that allows the heat to build up.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
And Sam, as we wrap up here, when you said residential customers get a delivery of 3 50-pound bags of compost, what's the schedule for that? And what does that compost look like? Does it look like basically like topsoil, or is it some other kind of consistency?
Yeah. So the schedule for it is, you know, we used to be doing it on a 3 times per year schedule. We'd bring it in the spring, summer, and fall. We just recently switched to a schedule where people can actually deliver it when they want it. So you can go onto the customer profiles that we create for each of our customer, and they can request it right from there. In terms of what it looks like, it's just really moist, rich soil. It crumbles nice in your hand. You can really like, it's got that really nice new soil smell. I think that they should make an air freshener out of it, truthfully, for your car. it's really good stuff. You know, we're happy to be able to bring it to our customers.
This would, I'll put it as a question. Would this be considered organic, as in, you know, USDA certified organic topsoil, or given that you're accepting compost from non-organic sources? I mean, does something in the process of the anaerobic digestion and all the other stuff that's happening, does that really render it into an organic product, or should people assume that it is not, in fact, actually organic?
So the place that we get this from is Connecticut NOFA certified, but there's no, we can't guarantee it, obviously, that this stuff is going to be, like if you're trying to grow only to organic standards, we can't really guarantee that this is going to be the right product for you. Mm-hmm. I have done some just cursory research myself about how toxins and things like pesticides can make it through the composting process, and there's no guarantee that all of that stuff is going to get basically like filtered out through the composting process. So if somebody is like really, really sensitive to that kind of stuff, then this might not be the right product for them. I think it's good for 99% of people and 99% of applications. And that's just because, you know, we're composting on such grand scales, and we see it as more ecologically and more like of our own personal missions. It's more important that we just make this something that's widely accepted, that, you know, food is not supposed to go in the trash. Right. And we don't care whether you're a large university or somebody who, you know, is composting at their home. We just want to make sure that we're capturing as much of that food and getting it out of the landfill and the incinerator. So we're okay with knowing that, you know, not all 100% of the food that's going in there is organic food.
Sam, it's been a fascinating conversation.